down at the local mill. Worked right up, not a millionaire. I can't pay my bills. The evil man is at my door. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. Well, I had me a wife, two car and a boat. Things got bad, now the boat won't float. I don't like it.
Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you on the air by listener-supported community radio, WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois. Views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Bill with some underwriting announcements.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at the Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, you can visit www.centralillinoisjwj.org. That's CentralIllinoisJWJ.org. The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio. And that's it.
Okay, Bill. Thank you very much. Okay, yes, there's a lot of interesting things going on in the world here this last week and stuff. And I'll start with a news story. I'm sure people have heard that about President Obama's statement that they want to lift the embargo against Cuba. But, you know, scratching the surface of this that statement and everything kind of the hoopla about it, it seems that although President Barack Obama shifted the longstanding American policy on Wednesday, the embargo and the lesser-known but critically important Cuban Adjustment Act are still in place, and there's no real prospect that the Republican-controlled Congress will change him in the new year. And Obama's new policy on Cuba effectively ends the embargo, as Florida and the world have known it for more than half a century, most likely leading to its gradual phase-out, but that's speculation. But significant parts will remain in effect, including a ban on American tourism to Cuba. The only exception has been that corporations, American corporations, can now do business with Cuba under certain conditions. Obama made extraordinary use of his executive authority to greatly alter the U.S. relationship with Cuba. The new policy also may lead to alterations of the Cuban Adjustment Act, which gives Cuban arrivals extraordinary rights compared to other would-be immigrants under the act. And what is known as the, quote, wet foot, dry foot policy, Cubans who set foot on U.S. soil are allowed to remain in the country, no questions asked. They are treated as refugees and are eligible for resettlement aid. Others who are caught from other immigrants who are caught from other countries while trying to enter outside legal channels are turned away, detained, and deported. Obama on Wednesday said U.S. officials will talk with Cubans about migration between the countries, likely leading to new immigration rules. But the Cuban Adjustment Act remains in force in the meantime. Public opinion has shifted more than the positions of Florida's elected officials. Less than a generation ago, calling for the end of the trade embargo against Cuba would have been unthinkable, the equivalent of stepping on a political landmine. But public opinion polling released earlier this year by the Atlantic Council's Adrian Arsh Latin American Center, a nonprofit business and cultural group, found 63% of Floridians support normalization relations or engaging more directly with the Cuban government, including a significant number of younger Cuban Americans, with only 30% opposed. Nationwide, the percentage favoring normalizations with Cuba is much higher than the 63% approval in Florida. So, Bill, what's anything interesting that caught your attention this week?
No, there wasn't any big Kardashian things or anything like that. Renee Zellweger's face was not a controversy either. Well, one thing that did, and I kind of got all over Dick Durbin about this, too, through the medium of the internet. And that is, I'm not real happy with what I've heard about this Cromnibus, or what I call the corporate Cromnibus bill. Budget bill. For example, I thought I had a guaranteed benefit pension. Well, I guess I don't have that anymore from what I hear. Yeah, that, the pensions are gonna be able to, you know, cut after you start collecting. If they, if they need to. I don't really know a lot of the details, but it was getting a lot of, a lot of people were not happy about it. Well, with some other things. I mean, see, that's not part of the budget.
Right.
You know, why, you know, but they throw it in there. What were some of the other things? There was a lot of, I wish I could remember now. Look something up here.
So more attack on people's retirements. I mean, in addition to state workers' pensions, Social Security, now this.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I hadn't thought about this today.
Yeah, you know, I live on a carpenter's pension. And, you know, myself and other tradesmen who have similar pensions, which are defined benefit plans, unlike the 401k or other employer-based pensions, they're protected under ERISA laws, which is a department of the federal government, which are supposed to, you know, they basically have these real strict requirements on the pension funds that they have to be so certain degree of cash reserves and, you know, a lot of other requirements and stuff. And frankly, we thought we were pretty secure, that no one would be able to touch our pensions, but now it seems like they're coming after that as well. And you know what this all boils down to, whether it's defined benefit pensions like we get in the construction trade, whether it's state employee pensions, whether it's Social Security, is that basically the banks, investment houses want to get a hold of this money, you know, because to them, in their view, it's just sitting there, not doing anything, quote unquote, productive from their point of view.
Here's one of the big ones. I forgot. I'm sorry. This is one of the things I got on Dick Durbin's website and sent him a message and told him I was just really upset with him about this. Another part of it too was they raised, and this is not part of the budget. They raised political campaign contribution limits for individuals from $32,400 a year, campaign, I guess, per candidate to $324,000. 10 times. I mean, man, that is just legalized bribery.
It more so. I mean, by tenfold. You know, I mean, that's just the opposite of direction that we need to be moving in this country. You know,
well,
this,
it's supposed to, money's supposed to be free. It's supposed to be speech.
Please.
You know, that's just allowing them to quash my individual speech.
And everyone else's.
Everybody else's individual speech that much more. What this, it is a zero sum as far as I'm concerned. Every dollar of speech that somebody else can spend that I can't spend is a dollar of speech that I lose.
Yeah. And in conjunction with that, there's no longer a fairness doctrine, like that used to exist prior to the election of Ronald Reagan, to where, you know, television, you know, stations had to give equal time to an opposing viewpoint. That doesn't exist. So, I mean, we don't have access to the media.
Yeah. Okay. Well, for example, in the 1980s, this is more, a lot on talk radio. And it's, one of the reasons why talk radio has just gotten completely out of control. And in some ways, I don't agree with the fairness doctrine because to me, it does seem restrictive of speech. However, back, it used to be if you had a political talk, news talk radio station, you had a, somebody who was at least perceived as a right-wing person, conservative, whatever, and then following that show, you had a show that was perceived on the other side, liberal, left, whatever. It was left, right, left is, you know, but sometimes the definitions of these things weren't that good.
Right.
But however it did, I thought it made more interesting talk radio networks. And it also got, you know, you did get that, more progressive, liberal side, mm-hmm. okay, which I think is important.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
but now it's just a proliferation, you know, 99% of the talk radio out there, maybe not 99%, but you're definitely in the 90 percentile range is all right wing, rabid right wing, you know, viewpoints.
Okay, yeah, for example.
And it's not what the listeners want. Our mutual friend Eric Sizemore pointed this out real well. It's not what the listeners, because that's what some people say, well, that's what the listeners want. You know, they're just supply and demand.
Oh, God,
no,
I hear that.
No.
You know, I'm about slapping nephew over that.
It's not what the listeners want. It's what the advertisers want.
Well, no, and then besides that, it's what the listeners get.
Yes.
And after you have it for a while and it's all there is, it's what is now normal to you. They're like right now, the radio stations in this area, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Christian, sports, oh boy, a new talk station came on in Decatur a couple of years ago. It's the B and C level of right wing crazy people. Okay.
What do you mean by B and C level?
Well, they don't get like Rush Limbaugh and Hannity. They get all these other guys that you never heard of.
Okay.
You know, Stevie J starts his station, breaks off from WDWS, starts his station, conservative and sports talk. You know, we get religion and about all the religious radio.
But not all religion, just fundamentalist Christian.
Yeah, but that's what's on the radio.
Yes.
And, you know, no wonder, you know, you have people, they aren't exposed to any other thing but Rush Limbaugh, yeah. Day in, day out.
Yeah. And that does affect people's perception of the reality. I mean, other than their day-to-day, you know, face-to-face contacts and experiences.
Well,
you know,
yeah, I would.
If they have nothing to counter it with, they just, a lot of people will believe this is true, what they're saying, say about, you know, what's happening in another part of the country or another part of the world.
Yeah, and it's like this. Would, say, my nephews be different if they had come up through, they're more like Reagan babies, you know, mm-hmm. 80s people. If they would have come up hearing, you know, when they got to the point where they were listening to something like that, which, you know, occurs maybe a little older for mm-hmm. most people. But if they would have heard Tom Hartman right after Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, which side would they, if they would have had the choice?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody gets the choice.
That's a very critical point.
And here's something, other thing, right wing radio person. Yeah. These stations, they won't let anybody on but the right wing,
yes.
So we don't know which would be, it might end up being more, Tom Harbin might end up being much more popular than Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah.
If they're on the same station.
I could guarantee you it would be the case, even though I have my criticism of Tom Hartman.
Well, I mean, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's like in this sphere of radio, we're talking, I mean, Tom Hartman will go so far to call himself a democratic socialist.
Yeah.
All right. And, you know, he has Bernie Sanders on a lot.
Yeah.
That's about as far left as you get on these kinds of stations, except for Mike Malloy, who's in his own category as a talk radio mm-hmm. host.
Okay.
But, I mean, I can just see that, I mean, it's no wonder.
Yeah.
And then, and you gotta remember too, every commercial just doesn't sell you a product or a service. Every commercial sells you capitalism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and, that's no problem. This could be one of the major differences between the United States and say Europe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, they have a different media system in those countries. I'm not real familiar with them, but I don't think that things fly like they do here.
No, definitely not. Okay, another interesting news story this week. Reverend Edward Pinckney in Benton Harbor, Michigan. The fight in Benton Harbor is a war. It's not a conflict. It's a war over whether America will have prosperity and democracy or live in poverty under the heel of open corporate rule. And that's a quote from Reverend Edward Pinckney, an African-American minister of Benton Harbor, Florida. As reports escalate of police assaults and murder of unarmed black men for suspected crimes, a jury trial certainly sounds like welcome justice. Not so for many in Michigan, where a 66-year-old black activist, Reverend Edward Pinckney, was convicted of felony election fraud by an all-white jury in a community that is 90% African-American, faces a life sentence amid accusations of trumped-up charges and no direct evidence of wrongdoing. When an all-white jury is chosen to try a prominent black community leader of an impoverished city with a 90% black population, when the powers that be have numerous reasons to want him discredited, when the evidence is entirely lacking and the punishment is draconian, there is ample cause to suspect another egregious breach of justice. One as blatant as refusing to indict the police who killed an unarmed teenager in Ferguson and choked a father of six to death in Staten Island. For decades, Reverend Pinckney has been a highly irritating thorn in the side of the Whirlpool Corporation and the power structure in Michigan, a state where racial and economic divisions are ugly and stark. In recent years, Democratic governance of six low-income majority African-American cities has been forcefully suspended. That is, elected mayor and elected city councils have been suspended by what's called an emergency management that's appointed by the governor of the state. Detroit is one of those as well. Pinckney is founder of BANCO, the Black Autonomy Network community organization, is arguably the loudest and most outspoken activist in Benton Harbor, which fell under the dictatorship of emergency management in 2010. His organization holds spirited rallies and takes political action against what the group claims is rampant government corporate collusion, police corruption, economic injustice, and a discriminatory, even genocidal plan for gentrification of the city. Reverend Pinckney has also taken on the dominant power in the city of Benton Harbor, the Whirlpool Corporation. The criminal charges against him stem from his attempt to recall Mayor James Hightower for foistering a multi-million dollar, not Jim Hightower, but James Hightower, for foistering a multi-million dollar loan on the citizens of the city to balance the budget while refusing to tax Whirlpool, a $19 billion Fortune 500 corporation that pays absolutely no taxes to Benton Harbor, where it is headquartered. A majority of city commissioners voted against the loan, but they were simply overruled by the emergency manager.
Oh, yeah. Where's Whirlpool having their stuff built lately?
Good question. I bet a lot of it's in Asia.
Because I noticed that's their headquarters, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. The charges against Reverend Pinckney derailed the petition to recall Mayor Hightower, who many believe would likely have been ousted had the election taken place, including former Benton Harbor City Commissioner Trenton Bowens, who just retired. I've never seen as many citizens so frustrated. They feel the mayor is for big business and not for the people. Pinckney is a radical. He wasn't on anyone's payroll. He was protesting at the hospital, the courthouse, the mayor's house, city hall. If the status quo does not like you, they will do anything to get rid of you. It's a sad day. This was a quote from one of the residents. No direct evidence was presented to the all-white jury to implicate Reverend Pinckney, who was charged with altering data on public petitions to recall Mayor Hightower. The charge was that some signatures were made one day prior to the 60-day window required by state law, and the dates were later changed to make the signatures valid. The signatories testified that they had signed the petition on the correct date in question, and no one claimed that they saw Reverend Pinckney change any dates. Mark Goff, a forensic document examiner of the Michigan State Police, stated the dates were written with two different inks, but that he could not determine who made the changes or when they were made. The crime itself of altering data on petitions is only a misdemeanor offense under Michigan law. Despite all this, the white prosecutor decided to charge Reverend Pinckney with five counts of felony election fraud forgery. The 66-year-old activist was convicted on November 3rd and now faces up to a maximum life sentence. He was sentenced by the judge on December 15th for a 10 to 25-year prison sentence. The case is currently being appealed. Reverend Pinckney's arrest began with similar overkill in May when neighbors reported that an armed police team had stormed into his house to arrest him. They could have just called me on the phone, says Reverend Pinckney, who had taken his wife out to dinner for her birthday. His attorney, Tap Parrish, had already informed the state that his client would turn himself in. They put me under house arrest and said they would monitor me by satellite, very unusual for a recall petition. In stark contrast, the surprise write-in victory of a white outsider candidate, someone who just moved into the community, Mike Dugan, as Detroit mayor in 2013, was riddled with public accusations of fraud and numerous submissions of evidence, but that highly questionable election was never even officially investigated. Gene Vortkamp, former Detroit mayoral candidate and election integrity activist, presented evidence of Dugan's write-in ballots with clearly identical handwriting to election officials, but was completely ignored. Appealing for support in his case, Reverend Pinckney writes, this is not a thing of black against white. It is rich against poor and the haves against the have-nots. Corporate fascism is here now. We must stand together and fight this police state. Together we stand, divided we fall. there is more power in the people than people in power. So this is we'll keep following this case, and just to let the listeners know that I've been trying without success, unfortunately, to get somebody to call into the Labor Hour here, World Labor Hour, from Detroit to give us a little report and update about what's going on there, because we've talked about a little bit on the air, but it's just unbelievable. I mean, if you know, if this spreads, I mean, this is basically not just a threat to our economic working people's economic you know, standard of living, but is a real threat to democracy itself. And with this coming Trans-Pacific Partnership, if this thing passes with fast-track authority, I mean, we're going to see probably a lot more cases of this happening around the country.
Well, okay, Dave. Here's one story about Whirlpool. This is from 2010. They decided to move a factory from Evansville, Indiana, to Mexico, and so Evansville area is going to lose 1,100 jobs. So thank you, Whirlpool.
Okay.
We're gonna, okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's another one, too. I wanted to get back a little bit to the pension thing, because here we go. This is from a website called Naked Capitalism, which is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a quote here. They're quoting Politico. I don't kind of like that, but
yeah.
We have to. The House Rules Committee added the Klein-Miller Amendment to the $1.1 trillion omnibus spending bill last night. The major would give multi-employer pension trustees. That's me and you, Dave.
Yes.
I forgot about that.
No, we're under their control. We're not them. Yeah, exactly.
I know, but
yeah.
I mean, we have multi-employer pensions.
Yes.
The option to cut vested benefits in order to save plans headed toward insolvency and would increase insurance premiums to the financially troubled Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, something that I want to mention here about the PBGC
mm-hmm.
is that it's become in a lot of trouble itself, because there are fewer and fewer and fewer pension programs that it covers. Thus, it gets fewer and fewer and fewer payments. Okay? And that started, of course, with the big things. Now they're giving IRAs and stuff that don't come under this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, hardly anybody in the United States has a pension that would be under the Guarantee Corporation anymore.
Except in the construction trade.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, and possibly some upper level jobs where they might have real mm-hmm. pensions, you know, some golden parachutes.
Yeah,
or something.
It's called the defined benefit pension. Yes.
But it says here, you know, it's like, they're saying multi-employer plans now, which I guess covers 1.5 million workers, according to this article.
Mm-hmm.
But that just sets a precedent to go after the, I guess about 10 million workers outside of the multi-employer programs who have these pensions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, I will definitely keep an eye on that. We're going to take a quick music break here, and we'll be right back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on listener-supported community radio station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. Okay, we're back, and that was some music. The song of that was 1936, Mi Puebla en Armas. And so basically it's, I think, a song, a punk version of a song from the Spanish Civil War. But
My Town
in Arms, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I have to say that this was a song, actually a compilation CD that was basically given to me by a friend of mine, Dave P, who's been on the show before and everything. So if he's listening, give a holler out to him. But anyway,
hi, Dave.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, but anyway, we're back, and we were supposed to have a couple guests on today, and unfortunately both of them couldn't make it. One was a woman who's originally from Honduras, to talk about what's been going on down there recently, as well as sort of some of her experiences working in Champaign-Urbana with some of the local hotels and how they're exploiting undocumented workers. She's married to an American citizen. She has a green card. She's a naturalized legal resident alien. So she can, you know, legally work and stuff. But she was going to talk about the experiences she's seen in the last few years about how a lot of these employers, some of these local hotels, mainly cleaning women, have been just exploited beyond belief, how a lot of these hotels prefer to hire undocumented people so that they can exploit them, you know, everything from paying below minimum wage to cheating them on their hours and et cetera and so forth. So unfortunately, she wasn't able to make it today, and we were also supposed to have somebody from the immigration, local Champaign-Urbana immigration forum on here, and they also were not able to come. So I guess, you know, we're just going to have to try to talk a little bit about you know, things that have been going on, you know, because this whole thing with the sort of easing a bit of the Cuban embargo kind of brought this to kind of attention.
I want to go down
talk about
buy
Latin
cars,
America,
man.
Well, yeah.
They still got
can
all
you imagine
cars from the 1950s?
If they totally lifted embargo, you're not the only one, I'm sure, that's come up with that idea. And being there back in the summer of June of 2012, I can tell you that about every fourth car on the road is a pre-1960 automobile. They're incredible shape. I mean, my gosh.
Well, it used to be you could go down somewhere like Kentucky and get cars, mm-hmm. use cars, and bring them up here and make money doing that. You know?
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
That was major. What I'm thinking is, well, gee, now they're opening up to exploitation.
Well, that's the thing. That's what I'm concerned about, because my wife, who's originally from Germany, family, or her mother's family came from Poland, and she still has a cousin that lives in Poland. And I remember, you know, back when the Cold War ended in 1989, 1990, how just from personal experience, you know, my wife talking to her cousin in Poland, about how they were expecting, that they were going to become like Germany or West Germany or, you know, Denmark or whatever, as far as the guaranteed health care and a good, you know, higher standard of living, because this is what they were told all the time that, you know, they could have if they weren't under.
There's another one too. I'm sure they had guaranteed health care under the
communist
regime.
Yes, they did.
See, that was one of the things, and people in Russia are not happy now.
Yeah.
And some of them are looking back to that and thinking, well, you know, we had to stand in line, but at least we got something.
That's the whole point. They were promised they're going to get getting, you know, higher incomes.
We had eight people in an apartment, but at least we had an apartment.
It wasn't quite that bad, but yeah. Shortages, you know, not having to stand in line to get certain, you know, all these consumer goods, everything else. They were told all this. And then what happens is the reality, what happened was...
Shock therapy.
Exactly. Shock doctrine. And half the country lost their job. Food prices tripled and rents quadrupled.
Yeah, but the guy, they termed it shock therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And the person who is largely responsible for it, Jeffrey Sachs.
Mm-hmm.
After he saw what happened, he's really changed his tune.
Yes. And this happened throughout the whole Eastern.
It's too bad, tens of millions of people got really screwed over by it.
Yeah.
So he could have a learning experience.
Yeah, and make a lot of money in the process. Right. All of Eastern Europe and Russia experienced this. And the whole purpose of shock doctrine or shock therapy is to basically, to break down the social and political, fabric of a country, in order to institute lower wages and you know, other things to push the country's standard of living down to benefit corporations.
Yeah, but I mean, I think this is a little bit of a different situation, because what they were doing was you had three alternatives. All right, you had staying with some kind of communist socialist state.
Mm-hmm.
The other extreme was what actually happened.
Yeah,
the shock therapy, and the reason I'm calling it shock therapy is because the third alternative would be somewhere in between or slowly easing from one thing to another. And instead they just came in and just said, that's it. We're going straight to these things.
Right.
You know, and that's, and that, I know, and what happened there was actually, it seemed more like the oligarchs mm-hmm. were homegrown. It didn't seem like Western corporations got so much.
Well, what
I could see.
How that phenomena happened, and this is what I, my worry about Cuba, if the embargo completely drops, is that, these former Communist Party officials basically just sold off state assets for pennies right. on the dollar, and they became instant multimillionaire, even billionaires.
Yeah.
And that's what I worry about, what's going to happen to Cuba. Because, you know, there's a precedent for this, and, you know, they're talking about Cuba wants to, institute, they want to basically phase out, state-owned, places, because what's interesting is everything, I mean, even a little corner, hole-in-the-wall bar or restaurant
right.
is owned by the actual Cuban government, which is, and everybody's an employee. The only exceptions are people that with their own automobiles that act as taxi drivers, people that rent out rooms in their homes to foreign tourists, and people that rent out maybe the front of their house as like their own little restaurant. Those are the only, and people having push carts to sell stuff on the streets. Those are the only exceptions to that. But what they were talking about when I was down there at the University of Havana was that they basically have started this already in agriculture. They wanted to where they want to phase out the state-owned businesses and turn them over, make them into worker-owned cooperatives, which I think is the way that the Cuba should be developed.
Yes, I hope it does happen that way.
Yes.
And I see what happened. What happened in the Soviet Union anyway was like the shares of the state-owned companies were distributed.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was a lot of the, you know, people sold their shares out pretty much right away to those who became the oligarchs
mm-hmm.
instead of retaining their shares.
Well, they had no choice because they were starving.
Yeah, and that's part of, yeah. But that, and also too, Iraq was supposed to be the, epitome of free market
yes.
capitalism.
And Naomi Klein had a great article about that in the, was it the Atlantic or, what's the one that Seymour Hersh writes for all the time? Is it the Atlantic?
Well, I'm not sure.
Yeah. But, anyway, she had a great article in there. I mean, God, these people, I mean, they had plans to bring in McDonald's and, Ford Motor Company, you know, car manufacturing plants, and it was going to be, there were going to be no corporate taxes. Oh yeah, there was their fantasy of the, they wanted to make it a model for, the, laissez-faire, corporate.
Right, and one of the things that they did was ban the government unions.
Yes.
The unions that work for government enterprises, and under the old regime,
that's the
a lot of government-owned enterprises.
That was the only law they kept on the books, from the Saddam Hussein era, was the banning of, unions. Interesting enough.
Yeah, and see, well, here's something, and I don't know where to attribute this.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember what I read, but it's, I could probably find it. What happened after World War II was at that time we had the New Deal, more social democrat, run United States, and basically through the war, we were the most socialist, that we had ever been. I mean, World War II was a real command economy. It's like, okay, you guys quit making cars now, make tanks.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
And they didn't quit totally making cars, but the,
well, okay,
the significantly
but what I'm saying
cut back.
Is that
yes.
There was a, what I'm trying to talk about is the atmosphere and the culture
yes.
and the political culture at the time of the United States, which was expressed in, what they did after the war, which was rebuilding Western Europe and Japan. And at the same time, they helped them write their constitutions. And in a lot of ways, these constitutions were much more worker-friendly, much more communal, collectivist-friendly. And that's one of the reasons why Europe is so much different than the United States at this point in
mm-hmm.
terms of its culture and its economy and so on. And that was the same. And now in Iraq, That's when the conservative right-wing nut job libertarians, free market libertarians, had their chance to put on their demonstration.
Yeah.
And look what happened.
Yeah.
Look at Iraq. Look at Iraq.
Iraq. Iraq had one, it was one of the highest standard of living countries in the Arab world before the invasion.
Well, it's also, really, in a lot of ways, one of the most equal and, for a lot of groups of people, probably one of the more freest.
Yeah.
You know, for women, even though it was,
It was bad as far as being
authoritarian dictatorship.
A one-party Baathist political system and stuff, but you're right.
Which was put in place by the CIA.
Indeed, they overthrew
hired Saddam Hussein to help do that.
Yes, indeed, indeed. See, it's a familiar story, you know, we got going on here. Yeah, and it also had the top healthcare system in the Arab Middle East. What's interesting,
They had to steal the incubators from Kuwait.
Good point. That was weird.
Why would somebody think of incubators? I get thrown back.
Oh, it was, that story proved to be a total lie, of course.
Just somebody thinking that up is a sick person.
Yes.
Whoever thought that up should, I don't know, move to somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, this just goes to show you, the agenda here of the ruling class.
And that
in this
also shows you the depravity of public relations people, because it was a public relations firm that put that up.
Right.
Knowlton.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yes. And so getting back to Latin America, and particularly, Honduras is what we wanted to talk about today, is that there was a democratically elected president, Zelaya. Back in the, when was that? 2000, let me think here, 2006, he was elected president. And he attempted to make changes to the constitution to help more democratize, the election processes, basically direct elections by the people, for, I think it was their Senate, which was basically elected by the lower house, and also to make it to where, voter referendums could be used to, make laws and stuff. Well, there was a military coup that ousted, Manuel Zelaya. And it turned out, even though they vehemently denied it, but people, myself included, suspected, U.S., CIA involvement in that coup, and they denied it up and down, but then later, WikiLeaks, Julian Assange's organization had basically, some of the documents they had released, from the U.S. State Department that they had hacked into, showed cables going back that showed that the U.S. State Department, this was the last, year or so of the Bush administration, and the beginning, first year of the Obama administration, so they both did the same policy, worked hand in glove with the Honduran military to actually oust, and overthrow the democratically elected government of Manuel Zelaya. And what's happened since his overthrow was that immediately they started targeting union activists for, arrest, harassment, arrest, torture, and murder, as well as other community activists, journalists, we're talking about independent journalists, not CNN reporters, but local Honduran journalists, alternative media radio stations, which, a guy we know was one of the founders of WFT, Bill Taylor, has gone and helped set up a lot of these radio stations in Honduras, these independent ones, and also attacking the teachers union, in particular, trying to privatize the public education system there. And what's been happening here recently, that's been developing over time, is what I've been told by people from Honduras that live here in the community, is that the drug cartels have actually paid off the entire Honduran officer corps of the military. And that there's a climate of fear right now in Honduras to where people that basically their telephones are being monitored, their telephone calls, especially those going abroad, and there's a total state of fear. And so people wonder why a lot of these people sent their children up here a while back. I mean, this is what's happening, is that because of our government's foreign policy, it's creating these hellhole of countries that are basically forcing people to leave their country and try to, immigrate here illegally. And then we see now that Mexico, a similar kind of thing is starting to happen. They're targeting teachers' unions for attack, trying to privatize public education, going after union leaders.
Well, the teachers' union thing's been going on for several years.
It's been going on, that big revolt in Oaxaca, yes.
Yeah, and another thing, too, is that the Zetas, one of the major drug gangs, maybe the major drug gang, is actually ex-Mexican military people.
Yes.
Who just said, hell with it, we're going to go with this, man.
Yep.
They got military training, they got weapons, and now they got money.
Yes. So, you know, what is happening is the foreign policy of our government is making conditions horrible for the rest of the world in order to try to benefit the 1% elite, corporate elite of this country. And it's harming us as Americans, too, indirectly. You know, so, I mean, this is the thing. I mean, this whole immigration debate, we got to realize that, you know, most of these people that came, no one wants to leave their home and their community and travel abroad unless there's compelling reasons to, you know, like whether you're starving or being oppressed. And so people have to realize a lot of people who are against immigration, you know, saying that everybody should be deported if they're here illegally, has to realize that the reasons for why this has happened over the years. And then you have the corporate trade treaties like NAFTA that has also caused a lot of economic chaos in countries like Mexico. It didn't benefit the Mexican people. NAFTA, of course, most people out there know the harm it's done to American workers. I mean, you're talking about loss of over 2 million jobs in manufacturing sector that paid union wages and benefits, and it's resulted in a cost of basically a 20% reduction across the board in manufacturing wages in this country.
Oh, you know, you mentioned Naomi Klein.
Yes.
One of her things now is the 3-day work week to save the environment.
Oh, that's a good one. I like that.
I'm all for that.
Yeah.
You know, because I don't know, Dave, I don't want to work in a factory.
Yeah.
Okay? You know, well, Robert Reich, who learned a few lessons after he got his feet wet during the Clinton years in the real world.
Yeah.
He used to talk about symbolic analysts or something like that. I want to do something more like that. I don't want to work in a factory. Yeah. Tired of that. I mean,
nobody wants to work in a factory, but the thing is, we still need manufactured products, and if people are going to go do that work, because it is dirty work, and it's a lot of times dangerous work, but they gotta need to be paid, you know, livable wage with health and, you know, pension benefits, you know.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's what I'm sure, and that is true, but I don't know, I've been for all of that stuff, but it's just like, man, we can do other things. You see, we got CNC machines. You know, that's how come all those countries could do those things over there, because they don't need generations of craftsmen to build a guitar.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And they could build a really, really good guitar with hardly anybody ever touching it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not quite as good as a Gibson out of, I think they're out of Kalamazoo now.
Mm-hmm.
But, and that's what I'm saying. We could all have CNC machines and 3D printers, you know, and be doing things that I would, you know, that are, you know, much more than just manufacturing things for necessities, and go ahead and pay those other people. And then maybe they could buy, the stuff that we make, like our movies, our books.
What's a CNC machine, Bill?
A computer numerical control.
Which, basically does what?
Well, basically, what it is you have three axes of movement.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And these are in various designs, and then you can use various cutting heads
and
be built in various ways. In fact, there's a 25 video series on a website where a guy makes it at his kitchen table while his wife's yelling at him in Spanish and a dog's barking and kids are crying.
That's amazing technology.
Yeah. What it is, it's you have some type of cutting head.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And you have a machine that can move up and down a little bit, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Back and forth and forward and backwards, okay, on those three axes.
Yeah.
And it's controlled by a computer. And you can see, what I want one for is I want to do this concrete stuff. And some of it requires stenciling.
Okay.
And what I could do is take a picture of an object, reduce it down to line drawings or maybe shadow or something like that I can do in the concrete.
Mm-hmm.
And then create stencils with it.
Interesting. Okay, well, that's thanks for enlightening us on that. But yeah, the technology is
but
is
see, that's
incredible.
What I mean, Dave. Yeah. We don't need to have – if you watch this, there's these TV shows called – How It's Made.
Mm-hmm.
At least half of those shows aren't any people involved at all.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. We don't have to have poor people in Vietnam making stuff for us, because we can have machines and make it at our house.
And that's where it's heading. I mean, I don't think it's quite practically there yet, but that's really interesting.
It could be.
Sure.
We could have had total solar and wind power by now if we would have pushed it instead of going crazy in the 80s.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. Okay, quick music break. We'll be right back. You're listening to World Labor Hour on Listener Support Community Radio Station WFT in Champaign, Illinois.
Oh, by the way, the...
Come on, CD player.
Until the philosophy which old one race superior and another inferior.
Well, punch it up, man. Punch the one that's playing up.
Is finally.
It is.
And permanently.
Oh, okay. Is my, are the microphones open?
And abandoned. Everywhere is war. It's a war that until they're no longer first class and second class citizens of any nation, until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance than the color of his eyes. It's a war that until the basic human rights are equally guaranteed to all without regard to race. It is a war that until that day the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality will remain in but a fleeting illusion to be pursued but never attained. Now everywhere is war. War. And until the ignoble and unhappy regime that hold our brothers in Angola, in Mozambique, South Africa, subhuman bondage, have been toppled, totally destroyed. Well, everywhere is war. Is there war? War in the east, war in the west, war.
Okay, we're back. You're listening to World Labor Hour on Listener Support Community Radio Station WFT in Champaign. And, just to, kind of, conclude a little bit about immigration, and that is, like I said earlier, there's a lot of people that, advocate that we deport any undocumented person in this country. You have to realize that, you know, these are working people too. They've come here. Granted, you know, it wasn't legal, but the fact that they've lived here for years, sometimes decades, they've established families, been part of the community and stuff.
And at the very least, they pay sales taxes.
At the very
and
least.
Usually they have the other stuff gets deducted, but they can't file tax returns.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever money gets taken out of their checks just stays there.
Correct.
And they might not ever collect Social Security either.
Yes. On the other hand though, I do want to make the point about this is that, illegal immigration, the real culprit here are these major corporations that are getting rich by exploiting undocumented labor.
Well, it's just employers in general. I can tell you, man, a lot of this agriculture stuff, like in Florida and California,
yeah,
those aren't big corporations. Those are families. They're large family farms.
Yeah, large corporate.
But they're selling to a corporate. But it's more like a large family farm. And, they are jerks. They're probably incorporated, but it's not like General Motors.
Yes. But the thing is that they're the ones.
Now, I'm trying to say is that small family farmers can be jerks too.
True.
I mean, large family farmers.
What I'm trying to say is they're the ones that are making, they're profiting off of this. The problem is, though, that because of this, it has harmed, it's lowered working conditions and wage rates for everybody. You can't deny that fact. I mean, a lot of liberals don't want to talk about this.
Well, yeah, see, it's just like the Walmart thing where they push their suppliers.
Right.
But I just wanted to show that, you know, the agriculture thing, it's a different thing than most other stuff.
Anyway, a lot of liberals out there are trying to say that we need to support this Senate bill, you know, this immigration bill. If you looked at that bill,
no,
it's not an immigration bill. It's a labor exploitation bill. The bill is calling for basically an increase in the HB1 visa program.
Yeah, I don't understand that at all. You know, especially around here.
I call it the indentured servitude visa program because that's what it is.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, these people, of course, they'll work a lot cheaper, but how can they live here that much cheaper?
But then they're going to lay off, you know, people that are, you know, Americans or naturalized, you know, residents here, that are making, say, you know, if in case of an engineer or software designer, you know, $60,000-$70,000 a year, and hire these people for $30,000 or $40,000. Yeah. And the thing is that when they get somebody here on an HB1 visa, that person is basically their slave. I mean, in a sense that they can't quit. I mean, if they have a falling out with their employer, they've got like basically 2 weeks to get out of the country, you know, or they're going to be illegal.
Yeah.
I mean, and this is ridiculous. And this also lowers wage rates and working conditions, for people. Now, the thing is that
why do they need the H-1Bs for these things? Because they can do it over the internet.
Well, some cases you can, you know, but the thing is that also what this Senate bill wants to do is they want to be able to have like a guest worker farm, you know, worker program to where people from Mexico or other countries come here and work picking, you know, tomatoes or whatever during the season.
That's the old bracero.
And not pay the minimum wage, not have any kind of the usual worker protections there, you know, and everything. And so, like I said, this Senate bill is not a solution, okay, in my opinion, to the immigration problem.
Dave, let me say this about agriculture again.
Yes.
All right. Agriculture has never, back when my dad had what we used to call the hired man,
mm-hmm,
everybody had the hired man because we had more work to do back then, okay? Mm-hmm. They didn't get unemployment.
Yes.
Or they weren't protected by they weren't protected by the Fair Labor Standards Act.
Yes.
At all. They didn't get unemployment,
mm-hmm,
or anything like that. I mean, that was with native born white men.
Mm-hmm.
you know, so.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, I'm just saying, this Senate bill is not the solution. It's not an immigration bill. It's a further labor exploitation bill. What needs to happen, in my opinion, is just everybody can prove that they've, you know, that's undocumented, can prove that they've lived here for, you know, and working here for, say, a year, give them a green card. Because that way, then they can't be exploited. You know, that takes pretty much, as far as I'm concerned, takes out the whole exploitation dynamic.
Well, it's basically like 1986. It's time to hit the reset button.
Mm-hmm.
He hit the reset button, then actually enforce the laws that you have after that.
Well, and I also advocated significantly increasing fines with even jail time for employers who break the law and hire.
Yeah, that's what
orders.
I would concentrate on. I would concentrate on that rather than deporting people.
Oh, that's
which
horrible.
Obama has been doing his whole
thing. Right.
These people coming out saying, oh, he's still going to be give immigrants everything. He's been almost a record holder in deportations.
Well, I mean, that's the thing is a lot of the immigration activists have confronted Obama at public gatherings, embarrassed mm-hmm. him, you know. I mean, they don't.
But are employers going to jail? Are they hitting heavy fines?
Heck,
or are people just being deported?
Yeah, exactly. That's what's happening. See, again, you know, we've got a system in this country that's being, you know, it's being perpetuated and expanded to where basically corporations have all the rights. They control our media. They control our government. And individuals, especially, you know, working people, have fewer rights, and our standard of living is falling. And as far as an ending note here, I had a news story that I've got to read here that I wasn't able to get in earlier. It's from Vermont. State House on Thursday, a sign directed at Democratic Governor Peter Shumlin reads, "Your career is toast." Protesters from across the state descended on Montpelier, Vermont Thursday to voice their anger with Governor Peter Shumlin's decision to drop his pursuit of single-payer health care. "All people, all care, make the rich pay their share," they shouted. "The system, let's stop it. Our health is not for profit." Many shared personal stories of struggle to afford health insurance or medical services, highlighting barriers to care such as high deductibles, co-payments, and other forms of cost sharing. Several burned medical bills they said would never be able to pay. Among those was Cindy Taylor, 48, of Bennington, Vermont, who burned $3,000 in bills from two separate emergency room visits for her daughter that were close to 8 years old. Her daughter, now 24, had to drop out of college college because of medical debt and is currently uninsured because she can't afford the premiums on the health exchanges. Protesters focused their ire on Shumlin. The governor acknowledged the disappointment of supporters in March Wednesday, but said the economics of a single payer wouldn't allow the program to move forward anytime soon. He called it the biggest disappointment of his public service so far. But protesters were not convinced and unappeased Thursday, asserting that Shumlin supported single payer why it was politically advantageous, but turned his back on the interests of the working class when he encountered resistance from business leaders and the Obama administration. They marched up to his office in the State House to deliver a platter of toast with the message, "Dear Shumlin, your career is toast." The protest was organized by the Workers' Center, an affiliate of the Vermont Jobs with Justice, whose director, James Haslam, who strongly condemned the governor's reversal on single payer as a betrayal of thousands of his supporters. We had somebody on the Labor Hour actually call in about a year and a half ago from the Vermont Workers' Center. And you got to remember, Vermont already has a state single payer system set up. It was voted into law and signed by this Governor Shumlin. This took years of organizing on the ground to force this to happen. They've got a system already set up and ready to go. The problem is that a lot of people don't realize that part of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, has, among other things in it, a prohibition against state single-payer systems until 2017 at the earliest. And what was going on was, various news stories that back this one up, was that the state of Vermont, that's already set up the system, already has a state board to administer it, to begin the process of setting it up in 2017, began the paperwork of the federal government, and the federal government, I guess, evidently told them that, told the governor that there was no way they were going to approve it in 2017. And I predicted this, as well as other people around the country, that this was going to happen, that come 2017 or before, they were going to throw all sorts of roadblocks up to prevent single-payer health care.
I just don't think it's going to happen on state level. Possibly in California. I don't think Vermont has the economy.
Well, they do. The thing is that this has not just been pulled out of their rear end. They set this up. They've had economists come in and do all the crunch, all the numbers and stuff, and it was ready to go. It was going to cost the state of Vermont a little bit of money the first year, but by year two, it was going to be self-sustaining. And the thing is that what we really need is a single-payer system like every other civilized country in the world, except the United States and South Africa, that has to be nationwide.
Well, Dave, if Vermont can do it, Champaign County should be able to do it.
Well, I don't think Champaign County has the economies of scale to do it. But the thing is that
there are efforts. Well, that's what I was saying about Vermont.
Yeah. But the problem, Bill, is that, you know, when you try to get a national payer, single-payer system enacted at this point in time with the current government we have in power in Washington, D.C., I mean, bumping up against all these corporate lobbyists from the pharmaceutical and private healthcare industry, that's why the focus shifted to the states. Because you got a lot better chance of trying to enact a system at state level than you do at DC. And by doing this, if you can get one state after another, you build momentum.
Well, I know that's what happened in Canada.
And that's what happened in Canada.
The states in Canada are bigger than the states in the United States generally.
Oh, in geographical
size.
But not population, yes.
But I don't know. It's not going to happen in Illinois, and that's for sure.
It's going to happen, Bill. It's just going to take a lot of time. You got to understand, there's a lot of money behind to prevent this. You can't, if you're a single payer advocate organization, you cannot get any kind of foundation or grant money of any kind. None whatsoever. You're going to be ignored by the corporate media, not just by the corporate media, but the so-called progressive liberal media that's out there singing the praises of the Affordable Care Act. I saw a program, and I can't remember which one it was. It was one I wasn't familiar with on Free Speech TV last week that just absolutely disgusted me. I mean, they had this guy on who was, of course, talking about how wonderful the Affordable Care Act.
Free Speech TV is going downhill.
Yeah, I believe it. This guy was singing in praise of the Affordable Care Act and was talking in the most elitist, condescending way about working people I have ever heard. Talking about, well, you know, there's all this whining about people who can't afford health care policies on the exchanges, you know, for Obamacare. Well, maybe if they drink less six packs every week and smoke fewer packs of cigarettes, they can afford it. It's like, are you kidding me? This was on Free Speech TV. And of course, they've been ignoring in general. In fact, a lot of people tried to call into Tom Hartman when we were discussing this. And of course, when you call in, they ask you what you want to talk about. And they asked you, like, when he's talking about the Affordable Care Act, if you're for or against. And I called in a lot of other single payer advocates and stated what we were against the Affordable Care Act, but we weren't doing it from a right wing perspective, but that we were advocating advocating single payer. None of us got on the air. None of us got to voice that opinion. And this has been typical in the liberal progressive media. The Nation ignores it. Free Speech TV, Tom Hartman, you name it. They all ignore the movement of single payer.
Where they went really too far in the morning is have you watched her yet?
Who?
Stephanie Miller is on in the mornings.
Yes, that is
horrible
she program.
Is a total Democrat, Obama.
Yeah, Obama can do no wrong. Fan. Democrats can do no wrong. Yeah, it's all the Republicans.
She was one of the people that was getting down on Edward Snowden recently.
There
was
really?
A lot of Democrat-type media people that were down on Snowden because of his things. Yeah, this NSA is doing it under Obama.
Yes, yes,
you know,
indeed.
Go with that,
yes, and this is the problem. You know, that's why working people in general, we need to, no one's gonna give us anything. We're gonna have to fight for it. Anything that's ever changed for the better in this country has always involved a fight. And it'll never change. That's always how it's gonna be because the rich and powerful aren't gonna give up any of their wealth or privilege, unless they're forced to. And, likewise with the media. We've got to create our own media. We've got to, support our own media. That's why it's important
Dave.
To support programs like ours and WFT in general.
I'll tell you something. The reason these things can get done in Vermont is because people will get out on the ground and go out and actually talk to people. That's how Bernie Sanders gets elected there. That's how they get this health care. You have to go out and talk to people.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
It's a state small enough you can do that. All you have to do here, it could be a snowball.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yes. Okay, you've been listening to World Labor Hour on Listener Supported WFT in Champaign, and tune in next week. And in the meantime, be safe and power to the people. Take care. Always stay tuned for the Union Edge with host Charles Showalter.